Let's start with the three homages. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Now I have to get used to speaking to a group all over again. I love talking about the Dharma, as I think you all do. I have a really hard time giving a Dharma talk, and I don't understand why that is. So, the first Dharma talk I ever gave, I was quite a young monk. It was at an introductory retreat. It was very small. There were four people there. And in the middle of it, a young woman got up and walked out. I found out later that she threw up and called her boyfriend and asked him to come and pick her up. That was my first experience giving a Dharma talk. And what I did find out later, and poor thing, she may really have been ill, but it did turn out that she was a student in a religious class, you know, at college. And so she came, I think, for the weekend to observe. Now, this is a dicey prospect because you just don't know what you're getting in for. And you can't actually observe, can you? So I have no idea. But in any case, after that, I became very kind of hyper-vigilant. I'm always concerned anyway about, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, but I'm a delusion type. So I'm always kind of concerned as to whether or not, you know, this is my view, and so not selling the wine of delusion, and not leading people down astray or down the garden path. So I can remember, again, very early on saying to the monk who had asked me to give the Dharma talk, after the Dharma talk, I went up to him and I told him all the things that I had said. I was so worried, you know, I said this, I said that, you know, do you think maybe they misunderstood this or that? I went on and on, and finally he said, "Kodo," he said, "when we hear a Dharma talk, we're lucky if we remember one thing." Now, that's a very funny thing, actually, because I've had this experience, and I know other people have said the same. You can hear a Dharma talk, and it really resonates with you. You walk out, and you go down the cloister, and somebody says, "Oh, I missed the Dharma talk. What was it about?" I think, what? You have no idea. Is this a common, do some of you have? Yeah. So what happens is the Dharma goes right in. You know, it bypasses the intellect, and it goes right into the heart, and there it is. And it is doing its work, and it will appear at some form at a later time, perhaps not even in a form that we would recognize. But we know it's there. And so again, as we were talking about this morning, to simply trust when you hear a talk or when you read the Dharma, that's something that you are hearing what you need to at that time. I've also had the experience and heard others say the same. You can read something in a book and just think, "Oh, isn't that something?" And then go back a week later and try to find it, and you can't find it. Because you have changed, and you're just not responding to that particular thing at that moment. as you did initially. So, you know, there's nothing to hold on to, really. There's nothing that we can carve in stone. And so the only thing we can do is trust our hearts. Yeah, we were talking about that this morning. We talked about a lot of things this morning, actually, that I was going to talk about one way or another. So happily enough, my talk has been rearranged in some kind of way that I'm not really going to be able to rely on it. So we'll just kind of hope for the best. But along the lines of what I was just mentioning about how we take in the Dharma, I love this phrase of Reverend Master Hubert. Some of you have heard me say it before. He translated something many years ago and said, "There are 84,000 parts to the sentient being. Only one of them is the intellect." So that leaves us 83,999 other ways to take in the Dharma. And for those of you with medical background, we were talking about this morning, you know, what about that? We have these ways, and nobody can explain it, really. And that's why this is a religious practice. So I wanted to say just a little bit about how I came to meet Reverend Master Jiyu. That in itself was an opportunity that I had to put her teaching into practice, the way I met her, because what she said was, your difficulty or your koan can be a doorway in. And actually, that's what brought you all here, if you think about it. So whatever you've been struggling with turns out to be the doorway in. However long it takes you to find that, it's always been open. And when I met her, I was living in the Bay Area. That was in the 1970s. And that was a very, very lively time. Very lively. Political protest and the flower children, psychedelics, all kinds of things were going on then. And it was a very rich time. People were questioning everything. You know, everything was up for grabs. And this really was the atmosphere in which Reverend Master Jiyu came from Japan and started to find people who were interested in meditating. And now, before I met her, I had been practicing with a group that had a Japanese abbot, and I was drawn to it because of the cultural aspects of it. It seemed very exotic to me. There was a lot that I couldn't understand. And because my koan was with boredom and everyday life, I was looking for something exotic and far out, and it was a perfect fit. It was perfect. And so I learned how to meditate there, and I stayed with that group for a while. I was really haunted by the idea that the reason I was having so much trouble with daily life, because I kept thinking there's something more important I should be doing, and I didn't know what it was. I certainly didn't think it was grocery shopping and cleaning and balancing my checkbook and all of this kind of thing. And what I didn't realize was that there was a lot of fear and anxiety going on, and it was masking as boredom. So I was looking for something unusual. In the meantime, my personal life was really falling apart. My mother was dying. I was getting a divorce, and I realized that the work I had been training myself for was something I was really not going to be able to do. So I had no idea what to do. So I went up on the Oregon coast, and while I was up there, I had a letter from a friend who said, I've been going to UC in Berkeley, and there's a female Roshi giving classes there. When you get back, I will take you. I think you will like her. So when I got back, I went, and I saw her, and as some of you have heard us describe our seeing her for the first time, here she was, this very large woman with a British accent, a shaved head, wearing a robe. And back in the 70s, that was very, very unusual to see a woman with a shaved head. And I remember just sitting and looking at her for about 20 minutes, just taking in this unusual sight. And then I started to listen to her. And in that very first time, it was very clear to me that she had found what I was looking for and that she knew how to help other people find it. So when the class was over, I said, when is she coming back? And that was really the beginning. Now, at that time, I had gotten a new job, and I was in deep trouble there. Looking back on it now, it was really quite embarrassing. I was very free with my opinions about how I thought it should be. Here I was, you know, a couple of years out of graduate school, and I really wasn't getting along with any of my supervisors. As a matter of fact, I asked to have a different one. You know, looking back on it, I think, you know, what in the world was I thinking? But, you know, at that age, anyway, they said they gave me 3 months to get my act together. They put me on probation. And during this time, I went to one of Reverend Master's talks, and somebody there asked my question for me, which is why I'm always encouraging you to ask questions, because you never know when it can be somebody else's. Somebody said, I'm having a terrible time with my boss. Do you have any advice? And she said, your boss has Buddha nature. And something about that just really struck me. And, you know, for the first time, I actually allowed myself to see this man with fresh eyes. I have to say, I allowed myself to do that because you know how that is. We go around kind of looking with one eye often, or you can see something out of the corner of your eye, but you really don't want to look because then you don't quite know what to do with it. And I just, you know, I saw him with fresh eyes, and I saw what it was he was dealing with. And I became very much more sympathetic, and I began to understand a little bit about the decisions that he was making and why he was making them. And as it turned out, I stayed on there for about another 10 years. And I had a series of things happen that I realized that if I was going really to find the Buddha nature, there was something that I was going to need to do. I was going to need to do it differently. And I remember I had a neighbor who used to play his music just as loudly as he could. He had a little mother-in-law cottage in the back of his yard. And he was living there, and I was sitting there trying to meditate. I was trying to meditate, and he was playing this music as just, you know, dear old Berkeley had such a very generous noise ordinance. You know, you could do anything until 11 o'clock at night. And so I went over to talk to this fellow. And as I was going up the walk to his house, I could hear the music was louder and louder. I was getting more and more upset. I was getting more and more angry. And I knocked on his door, and he opened the door, and he had headphones on. And when I saw that, you know, something in me just kind of let go. And I was so angry with him. I got so angry. I started to, I started to call him names and really yell at him. And he looked at me and he said, "Now, if you were having this conversation with me in a different tone of voice," he said, "this would be a different conversation." And he slammed the door. He slammed the door. And I went back to my meditation cushion. The great meditator. And I just sat there and I thought, well, now, isn't this something really? And so, you know, the next day I went over to his house and I knocked on the door and I said, "You know, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry for my behavior and I'm sorry I was rude to you." I said, "But your music is really loud. I wonder if you would mind turning it down." And he said, "Fine." He said, "Fine." And he did. And that was kind of a turning point for me to really see that when we act in accordance with someone's Buddha nature, that is the response. That's the response that we will get. Now, of course, it doesn't always happen that way, but I really started to go in that direction. And I tried to put into practice Reverend Master Jiyu's teaching on the precepts. Now, I want to read something to you. You know, we were talking this morning about meditation being coming home. And the precepts come out of meditation. And the precepts are about coming home. In my experience, people get very edgy when you mention the word precepts. You know, a lot of this is from our previous experience. We are bringing baggage that we may not be aware of. It can be from previous religious experience or just a sense of the precepts as being really restrictive. There was a graphic example of this that was given at a conference I went to where there were a number of monastics talking about how they had been trained in their tradition. And there was a monk from the Chinese Mahayana tradition who told about this incident. He was a Westerner. His master had blamed him for something that he hadn't actually done, and he took it very poorly. He was very defensive, and he was very worried, and he was very scared. And his master said to him, "After all these years, you still think the Buddha is a cop waiting to bust you." Now, isn't that the truth, really? So, I want to talk a little bit about how we can develop a more generous attitude toward ourselves and toward the precepts and get a little bit closer to the real intent and to the real meaning. I want to read something from a book called Being Upright by Reb Anderson, who has been an abbot at Zen Center, is now living in Green Gulch. He's written a book called Zen Meditation and the Bodhisattva Precepts, and he has a piece in it called Taking Refuge in the Buddha. To take refuge in Buddha means to take refuge in what you really are. What you really are is Buddha. Another part of what you are is a human being who keeps running away from what you are, who keeps trying to be something else. If you feel unworthy, then you want to change or somehow fix yourself. In other words, you can be distracted and undermined by your ideas about yourself. In that sense, you flee from yourself. Of course, you can never really run away from yourself. That's only a delusion. You need to balance this delusion of running away with the recognition that it is a delusion, that you didn't run away. Returning to Buddha is an antidote to running away from yourself. To come back, to just be the way you are, including all your delusions, is to take refuge in Buddha. I love that image of running away from home. Running away from home. When Master Jiu used to talk about the time when that usually happens, sometime around 7 years old, she would say, because that's about the time that you begin to be influenced by parents, teachers trying to please, and pulled out of your sitting place. And it takes as long as it takes to come back home. But this is why, it seems to me, so many people, when they come here, say, "It feels like coming home," even if they've never been here before. They're talking about coming back to their sitting place. Dogen says, it's futile to travel to other dusty countries, thus forsaking your own seat. He's not talking about traveling. He's not saying don't travel. He's just saying don't leave your spiritual home when you get on the airplane. And it's really interesting to me how many people respond to that particular piece of that scripture. There's a lot in that scripture that's hard to understand. but practically everybody understands that. It's futile to travel to other dusty countries. They're dusty. You know, there's no water there. There's no, the water of compassion that Avalokiteshvara is holding and sprinkling. Actually, that's what it is, isn't it? We have turned away from compassion toward ourselves when we run away from home. Yeah? So then he says, when I take refuge in Buddha, I don't take refuge in my good points or my skillful behavior, and of course I don't take refuge in my shortcomings. I take refuge in me being me. That is my indestructible virtue, which never is lost, except by me forgetting it, or by not facing up to it. Isn't that something? It's so easy for us to forget. That's why we have to keep coming back. You know how we say keep coming back? To keep coming back. So easy to forget. Or by not facing up to it. Now that is the scary part. Everybody's nodding, yeah. To take refuge means to give up running away from home. It means to recognize my responsibility to live in accord with my Buddhahood. Now that was a question that came up this morning, wasn't it? About what does it mean when we say everybody is Buddha? We are all Buddha. We have to act in accordance with that. When you take refuge in Buddha, when you go back to being fully yourself, you can begin to see how you are connected to and depend on everybody, and how everybody depends on you. In other words, the first refuge really contains the other two. When you take refuge in Buddha, you begin to understand the teaching of interdependence, which is taking refuge in Dharma. And you honor your connection with other beings, which is taking refuge in the Sangha. In fact, the practice of taking refuge in Buddha opens your eyes to all the other precepts: not killing, not stealing, right conduct, and working to help other beings. All these come from the condition of you being you. This is the source of peace and the source of love. In essence, to take refuge is to give up all alternatives to being Buddha, to being yourself. Actually, we don't have any alternatives, do we? But boy, have we spent a lot of time trying. When you come right down to it, we do not have any alternative but to be who we are. And this morning, Suzanne said, we are all different. Each of us has a different way of meditating, of finding that place during the day, of coming back to Buddha, however you want to call it. Not everybody wants to call it Buddha. You can call it whatever you want to. But the thing of it is, we are all different. we are all unique. Nobody is special, but we are unique. And so we can only find the way to do this practice that works for us. We can only really prove it to for ourselves. And this was Reverend Master Ju's great gift to us. She held out her faith to each of us that we could find this. I was just talking to Reverend Master Mato, who's visiting us from Malawa. We just had a moment to exchange a word. We used to be roommates, and we used to have endless talks in the hallway. It never occurred to us that we could actually go someplace and sit down and talk, so we used to talk in the hallway of the Lotus House. You know that little house there where the shop is? We had the two rooms in there, the office and the room next to it, which is now being used as a guest room. And she said to me this morning, she said, you know, Reverend Master G would never let anybody off the hook. She never let anybody off the hook. She always expected the best from everybody. Male, female, monk, lay, whoever it was, whatever it was. And those of you who remember going to her talks, she would always answer the question that anybody asked at the deepest level. You would think sometimes this perfectly ordinary question, you know, somebody's asking about, Beth is smiling back, somebody's asking about some perfectly practical thing. And she would respond from a spiritual place, because that's where the question was coming from, and the fact that I couldn't see that. That was my problem. But what an amazing thing that was, and so many people remember that about her. And she always she always recognized the person's aspiration. It didn't matter if they were interested in being a Buddhist or not. They were there at the talk. She was giving a talk about Buddhism and meditation. They were looking for something. And whether or not she, you know, they found it with her was never really an issue. She wanted to help people find it wherever they were. If they were coming from another tradition, she would encourage them to go deeper into that tradition and find it. So that was the teaching of the all is one and the all is different. That was just a very brief glimpse of it. I want to talk more about that another time, because that is one of those teachings that brought me to the practice, and that I am just now beginning to see the profundity of it, just the barest glimpse of that teaching. And actually, I think that teaching is vital to us, both on a personal level and what is going on in the world, is the recognition that we are all part of something which is greater, and we are all uniquely different. And as Anthony said this morning, we are what we have in common, we are all breathing. I hope I didn't misquote you. And it is so very easy to, as Dogen says, rub only part of the elephant. He says, do not waste so much time rubbing only part of the elephant. And he talks about looking with one eye. He He talks about not setting up the opposites. When the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. And how often we do that as a way of trying to understand what is going on. So, he says to take refuge is to give up all alternatives to being Buddha, to being yourself. When you see and accept that you have no such alternatives, you naturally and spontaneously go forward on the path of Buddha. When you are willing to throw yourself completely into your everyday life, moment by moment, you are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Taking refuge in the three treasures. Now, I mentioned this morning that there can be and has been a misunderstanding of the phrase, we are all Buddha. And I think this is a good description of how that came about in this book, Silent Rain, written by Ajahn Amaro, who is a Theravadan bhikkhu in the tradition of Ajahn Chah. He is now the abbot of Amaravati in England. And this is from a book he wrote some years back called Silent Rain. So he's a Westerner, but he lived in Thailand for many years. I always find it very helpful to read descriptions of things from monks who are either from other countries or have spent time in other countries, because they have a view. They've gotten far enough away from the Western way of looking at things that they can have a little bit of a perspective on some of the ways that we think about things. And what he says is, he was visiting in the Bay Area. He was there. So he was present for, he knew what some of the influences were there. And he said, with the early presence of Buddhism in America in the 1950s and early 60s, there was a tremendous amount of misunderstanding about this phrase, everyone is a Buddha. We're all Buddhas. Everyone is perfect. And instead of this giving rise to people having the conduct of Buddha, which is modest, gentle, and restrained, what this was sometimes taken as was a justification of license. Whatever you do, it's perfect. Sober is perfect. Drunk is perfect. To do whatever you feel like doing, whatever you're inspired to do, it's all empty. Empty in quotes. It's all suchness. For people who took that highest principle as a fixed position or identity to hold on to, you can just see that just the idea of it was not enough. And it caused some of the brightest Buddhist lights of the Beat Generation to die as alcoholics. There was a great sense of freedom of spirit that was inspiring it. But the idea of us all being Buddhas and everything being perfect is not the same as a direct realization of that. When the mind truly rests with that realization, then what flows forth from it is a purity of conduct, a purity of speech and action, a gentleness, a harmlessness, and a simplicity. The Buddha's response to his enlightenment, being totally free and beyond any suffering, was not to pursue physical pleasures or seek intoxication. His response was to live incredibly carefully and modestly, using the things of the earth with frugality. He could have conjured up anything he wanted, but he chose to live as a barefoot renunciate, a peaceful, harmless being. So You know, the precepts are what put us in harmony with our Buddha nature. And the thing of it is, although we have guidelines, they are not written in stone. You know, the first precept is cease from evil. And the reason it's written that way is because when we cease from evil, good arises naturally, because that is what is there. When we stop muddying the waters, then what is left is good. Do only good. Do good for others. Now, when I first heard that, do good for others, I almost got up and left. Because I had been struggling with trying to do good for others all my life, and it wasn't working out. And so when I heard that, I thought, oh no, not again. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, why don't I ask somebody? So I did. I wanted to talk to one of the monks. And I said, now I don't understand this do good for others. Does that mean, and this is one of those things that's just kind of etched in my brain, you know, one of those conversations was a turning point. Does that mean that I need to take in every stray animal that I see? Does that mean I need to open an orphanage? Does that mean I need to be nice to everybody? That was the hardest part. Sick, because I've been trying to do that all my life. I said, I really don't want to be doing that. And he said, no, doesn't mean that. Now, you know, I don't remember what he told me that it meant. I bet he didn't tell me. I don't really know that he told me, but the point of it was, it wasn't what I thought. It wasn't what I thought. Now, I'd like to tell you that that has a happy ending, but I want to say that a couple of months ago, I took refuge in one of my fellow seniors, and I said, I'm having a really bad time. I said, I'm feeling so crabby and judgmental toward everybody. And he said, well, work on it. And I said, work on it. I said, I've been trying to work on it all my life. Incidentally, this is not how you receive instruction if you've asked for help. This is not an example, but it just came forth. I said, I've been trying to work on it all my life. And he said, well, you're probably going to work on it till your dying breath. Okay? And something in me just relaxed. And I thought, okay, I can do that. I can do that. We are working on the Buddha's time. Do you know what I mean? This is his time frame, not ours. I'll probably be working on it into who knows how many lifetimes. But isn't that something that you can hear something like that? And it can just shift everything. You know, it's kind of like a kaleidoscope. A tiny little shift in one of those little pieces of glass and the whole picture changes. Okay, nobody expects me to have dealt with this in the next month or so. I'm the one. Yeah? I mean, look, we all know about this. This is really part. This is really part of our understanding about what is our relationship to our koan. You know, our koan is that which we are putting in the way of our relationship to the eternal, to the source, to Buddha nature, however you want to think about it. You know, you also hear the word defilements. Now that is a scary word. But it's one of those words that's just been translated. It's got that. I think that's a word that's hard for Westerners, you know. What it means is that which we have put in the way, the clouds that we have put in the way of our relationship with our true self. And every once in a while we get to have a little glimpse of that, and then the fog rolls in again. You know, it's like this mountain over here. This mountain is such a wonderful teacher. The mountain is always there, whether or not we can see it. We know it's there. We know it's there. And we can't just, you know, get on the freeway and drive when we don't see it in that direction and think we're cutting straight across. No, you have to go as the crow flies because the mountain is there. But that is such a good reminder. So I kind of got myself out of order. I'm not sure what I have said and what I haven't said, so I'm just going to have a quick look here. So part of the taking refuge in the three treasures, part of the practicing of the precepts, part of seeing the Buddha nature everywhere. She called that sanctifying the mundane. And that was the teaching that opened the door for me, because when I went to one of her talks and she said, Dogen says to live by Zen is to live an ordinary daily life. I thought, oh no. Ordinary daily life. It's the last thing I want to do. I was trying to get away from ordinary daily life. But then she talked about sanctifying it and making every aspect of our daily life part of our spiritual life. Now, we talked about that a little bit this morning. You know, the thing is, you all do it. Do we really recognize that that is what is happening? I want to share with you this article written by one of our Sangha members, Patrick Burrell. I hope he doesn't mind. But it's in the journal. So I think he would be okay with it. It's called An Improvised Altar. And he says, on my way home after meeting for meditation at a friend's house, I was thinking about the Abbey and especially the ceremony hall. I was missing the ceremony hall. It was a cool evening. I had gotten up quite early that morning, and after a day at work, I was now looking forward to a nice rest. As I came into the driveway, my wife, who'd heard the car, was standing by the door, and she announced to me that the baker who works the 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift had fallen sick quite suddenly and was unavailable to bake. That meant I had to go back to work. I was both surprised and disappointed. My first thought was, I can't do that. I worked all day. Then I tried to find ways to get out of it. I was both angry and fearful. First, I did not want to give up a quiet evening. Second, I did not know if I was capable of replacing someone as experienced as the night baker on such short notice. The squabbling and arguing went on for some time. I decided to get dressed, and soon after I was on my way to the bakery. As I was driving, some thoughts came to me. You are being called. How are you answering? Why don't you let go of all that noise? Do not get attached to all these feelings. Be still. Then I realized that earlier I had wished for a ceremony. Here it was, right in front of me. A great opportunity to offer up my resentments and insecurities, as well as my willingness to do what needed to be done. By now, my focus had switched from trying to get out of it to doing the best I could. I was no longer worried or concerned, and a sense of calm and determination had replaced all those previous feelings. I weighed carefully all the ingredients and placed them on the large wood altar. It was then that I decided that this was to be my altar for the night. Sorry, the large wood table, which he had decided would be his altar for the night. The batches of bread followed each other. The mixer was humming and making a smooth and silky dough. Unexpectedly, the morning baker came in 2 hours early and offered his help. It was so generous of him to give up 2 hours of sleep. We worked well and quietly together. The atmosphere around us was light and joyful. I had let go of some attachments, and everything seemed to be helping me to go on. A sense of gratefulness surrounded me. I was glad to have been able to catch that opportunity to train. Now, I remember Patrick telling me this story, and what he added was, when his employers came into the bakery, they noticed that there was just such a sense of lightness and peace that morning. Now, I am so struck by these words, "You are being called. How are you answering?" You're being called all the time, aren't you? You know, if you've got kids, be called in the middle of the night, you're changing diapers. If you have animals, you're called, you have to get up and let them out. You may have an aging parent that you're listening to be called about. Somebody calls you to replace somebody at work. You are endlessly being called. You're all on call, aren't you? If you're a doctor, you're on call. So the question is, how are we answering, isn't it? I was talking to one of our Sangha members a couple weeks ago who told me that just a child is about 2 years old, and she said she'd been having diapers in her life for years, washing diapers. And she said it finally dawned on her she's going to have diapers in her life for a long time. And she said, so she started feeling gratitude. She started feeling gratitude. Here she has this lovely child. She can afford to have diapers. She has a washing machine that can wash the diapers. She has a dryer that can dry the diapers. And she said she began to feel this boundless gratitude. This is sanctifying the mundane. This goes on all the time, doesn't it? So how can we find opportunities in our life to express this, perhaps whenever we remember, really? Because it really is one of those turning points, isn't it? I was reading something. A woman was telling her husband, "Gee, you know, I have to go pick up the kids, and then I've got to go grocery shopping, and then I have to go to the bank." And he looked at her and he said, "Why don't you say, I get to go pick up the kids. I get to go grocery shopping. I get to go to the bank." Isn't that something, how that, again, is that little shift in the kaleidoscope? And it's a whole other picture. And this is what Burman Master G was teaching, that these activities of daily life, taking out the garbage, she even mentioned, you know, the kids' diapers, all of these things. This is sanctifying the mundane. I was listening to some old tapes of in which she was talking at the Berkeley Priory many years ago, meeting with the congregation there. And I heard a familiar voice, someone whom we haven't seen in years, but was very active at the time and had a wonderful way of expressing things. And he said, you know, I'm learning a lot from my underwear. And again, I just remember being there when he said that, and my heart sank. I thought, oh, we're going to have a personal confession here. I hope this isn't going to be too embarrassing. And what he said, I went to sit down and meditate, he said, and I saw that my apartment, my living room, is just a mess. I've got clothes all over, and I've got dirty underwear everywhere. He said, I've got to clean up my apartment. He said, that mess is a reflection of the clutter in my mind. And so that's what he was learning from his underwear. Then he came in a couple of weeks later and he said, you know, last time I was talking about my underwear, he said, I don't spit in the street anymore. He said, I don't spit in the meditation hall. Why would I spit in the street? He said, the meditation hall is everywhere. That's, you know, when the learning comes from inside out. Now, it's interesting because since I heard that, I read several religious teachers use the expression, there is nowhere to spit, meaning every place is holy. And he had found that for himself. I should add, he was from New York City. You know, so isn't that, I mean, that's part of it too, right? It's kind of the all is different. That's what his experience was. And that's how the teaching was coming for him. This is how we learn from one another. That wonderful difference that we can share so that we can see things differently and go beyond the opposites. My gosh, it's 12 o'clock. So why don't we stop here and we'll have a chance for some questions this afternoon. 4 o'clock. I want to encourage you to bring your questions to the group if you can. What I want to say about that is some things it's really good to speak privately with someone if you have something on your mind. And the thing of it is, we are so much more alike than we are different, than your question could be the question that many others have. And so, you know, think about that possibility.